listeners, welcome to the Book Report. I'm your host, Elaine Charles, and judging by the calendar, the profusion of heart-shaped candy boxes in all the stores, and red roses everywhere you look, love is in the air. Let me start by wishing you a very happy Valentine's Day, and then let's jump right into a subject I love, books. Now, of course, we could spend the entire show delving into romance novels, but I thought it'd be fun to take a different approach. Since the Oscar nominations have been so recently announced, I thought we'd mix it up. We'll look at some of the great literary love stories that became Academy Award-winning films, and we'll preview some titles turned into films that Oscar seems to love this year.
Traditional advertising can be expensive and wasteful. But lately, you've been hearing a lot about social media and viral marketing. But let's be honest, it's confusing. That's why you need Magic Buzz, a new marketing company so unique, we've even coined a special phrase for what we do. Socio-viral. We combine the word-of-mouth friendliness of social media, like Facebook, Twitter, together with the viral reach power of YouTube, to create the socio-viral effect. The Magic Buzz team makes sure our clients are well represented online. We recently took word-of-mouth advertising to the number one position as most productive medium for a major cell phone company. That's right. Magic Buzz produced more sales than an expensive TV campaign at a fraction of the cost. Put the power of socio-viral marketing to work for you. Visit us at magicbuzz.com. M-A-G-I-C-B-U-Z.com. If you have any questions, please feel free to email us at info@magicbuzz.com. Magic Buzz, we're there when you can't be.
Whether or not you log on every day, or every hour, there's a good chance you've seen one of this year's Best Picture nominees, The Social Network. Facebook creator Mark Zuckerberg has been all over lately. I even saw him on Saturday Night Live a few weeks ago. The film has actually been nominated for 8 Academy Awards. While there are a plethora of recent books about Facebook, the movie is based on Ben Mezrich's The Accidental Billionaires, The Founding of Facebook. You're familiar with the story. Eduardo Saverin and Mark Zuckerberg were Harvard undergrads and best friends, outsiders at a school filled with polished prep school grads and longtime legacies. They shared both academic brilliance in math and a geeky awkwardness with women. One lonely night, Mark, a computer genius of the first order, hacked into the university's computer system, creating a ratable database of all the female students on campus, and subsequently crashing the university servers. He nearly got himself kicked out of school. In that moment, in his Harvard dorm room, the framework for Facebook was born. What followed? A real-life adventure filled with slick venture capitalists, stunning women, and 6'5" identical twin Olympic rowers. This makes for one of the most compelling books of the year. The Accidental Billionaires is the tale of the creation of a company that has revolutionized the way hundreds of millions of people relate to one another. It's narrated by Mike Chamberlain.
He hadn't grown up poor. He'd spent most of his childhood being shuttled between upper-middle-class communities in Brazil and Miami before matriculating at Harvard. But he was a complete stranger to the sort of old-world opulence this room represented. Even through the booze, Eduardo could feel the insecurities rumbling deep down in the pit of his stomach. He felt like a freshman all over again, stepping into Harvard Yard for the first time, wondering what the hell he was doing there, wondering how he could possibly belong in a place like that. How could he possibly belong in a place like this? He shifted against the sill, scanning the crowd of young men that filled most of the cavernous room. A mob, really, bunched together around the pair of makeshift bars that had been set up specifically for the event. The bars themselves were fairly shoddy, wooden tables that were little more than slabs, starkly out of character in such an austere setting. But nobody noticed, because the bars were staffed by the only girls in the room, matching bust-heavy blondes in low-cut black tops, brought in from one of the local all-female colleges to cater to the mob of young men. The mob, in many ways, was even more frightening than the building itself. Eduardo couldn't tell for sure, but he guessed there had to be about 200 of them, all male, all dressed in similar dark blazers and equally dark slacks. Sophomores, mostly. A mix of races, but there was something very similar about all the faces. The smiles that seemed so much easier than Eduardo's, the confidence in those 200 pairs of eyes. These kids weren't used to having to prove themselves. They belonged. For most of them, this party, this place, was just a formality. Eduardo took a deep breath, wincing slightly at the bitter tinge to the air. The ash from the bonfire outside was making its way through the window panes, but he didn't move away from his perch against the sill. Not yet. He wasn't ready yet. Instead, he let his attention settle on the group of blazers closest to him, four kids of medium build. He didn't recognize any of them from his classes. Two of the kids were blonde and preppy-looking, like they'd just stepped off a train from Connecticut. The third was Asian and seemed a little older, but it was hard to tell for sure. The fourth, however, African-American and very polished-looking, from his grin to his perfectly coiffed hair, was definitely a senior. Eduardo felt his back stiffen, and he glanced toward the black kid's tie. The color of the material was all the verification Eduardo needed. The kid was a senior, and it was time for Eduardo to make his move. Eduardo straightened his shoulders and pushed off of the sill. He nodded at the two Connecticut kids and the Asian, but his attention remained focused on the older kid and his solid, black, uniquely decorated tie. Eduardo Saverin. Eduardo introduced himself, vigorously shaking the kid's hand. Great to meet you. The kid responded with his own name, Darren something, which Eduardo filed away in the back of his memory. The kid's name didn't really matter. The tie alone told him everything he needed to know. The purpose of this entire evening lay in the little white birds that speckled the solid black material. The tie designated him as a member of the Phoenix SK. He was one of 20 or so hosts of the evening's affair, who were scattered among the 200 sophomore men. Saverin, you're the one with the hedge fund, right? Eduardo blushed. But inside, he was thrilled that the Phoenix member recognized his name. It was a bit of an exaggeration. He didn't have a hedge fund. He'd simply made some money investing with his brother during his sophomore summer, but he wasn't going to correct the mistake. If the Phoenix members were talking about him, if somehow they were impressed by what they'd heard, well, maybe he had a chance. It was a heady thought, and Eduardo's heart started to beat a little harder as he tried to spread just the right amount of bullshit to keep the senior interested. More than any test he'd taken freshman or sophomore year, this moment was going to define his future. Eduardo knew what it would mean to gain entrance to the Phoenix, for his social status during the last 2 years of college, and for his future, whatever future he chose to chase.
Social media. It's got everyone buzzing these days. But what is it really, and how can you put it to work for you? More than just a passing trend that's hot today, gone tomorrow, social media is marketing that is making a difference for savvy business people who have jumped into the future. Magic Buzz is a new online marketing company so unique, we've even coined a special phrase for what we do. Socio-viral. We combine the word-of-mouth friendliness of social media like Facebook and Twitter together with the viral reach power of YouTube to create the socio-viral effect. Magic Buzz's socio-viral solution provides the measurable value of online advertising that works, affordable, and effective. So get the buzz going for your business. Magic Buzz, with only one Z, because we're never asleep. Visit us at magicbuz.com. For more information or any questions, please feel free to email us at info@magicbuzz.com. Magic Buzz, we're there when you can't be.
In our jaunt through Oscar's favorites is the epic Titanic.
Who could ever forget Leo DiCaprio and Kate Winslet perched with arms outstretched, flying atop the bow of the doomed ship? Film buffs, take note. The movie will be re-released in 3D this April to commemorate the 100th anniversary of the sinking of the unsinkable ship. My guest, Hugh Brewster, is a Titanic expert. Hugh has written The Discovery of the Titanic with National Geographic personality Robert Ballard, Titanic, an Illustrated History, which was one of the inspirations for Cameron's award-winning film. Hugh also wrote the text for Inside the Titanic, and he co-compiled the book 882 and a half amazing answers to your questions about the Titanic. And now Hugh is set to bring out his Gilded Lives Fatal Voyage this April to coincide with the 100th anniversary of the Titanic tragedy. The book examines the lives of the wealthy and glamorous passengers aboard ship, an exquisite microcosm of the Edwardian era. Hugh got his start in publishing as a children's book editor for Scholastic Inc. in his native Canada and New York. Between 1984 and 2004, Hugh was the editorial director and publisher of Madison Press Books in Toronto. While there, he helped to create a number of successful books for young readers, including Exploring the Titanic, a title that has sold over 1 million copies. Hugh's own first title was Anastasia's Album, The Last Tsar's Youngest Daughter Tells Her Own Story. Hugh traveled to Moscow to see the last Tsar's palaces and review the personal possessions of the family, letters, photos, diaries, and school notebooks. These had been hidden in state archives for over 75 years. One of his titles, On Juno Beach, commemorating the 60th anniversary of D-Day, won the Children's Literature of Canada Information Book Award in 2005. Welcome, Hugh. It's great to have you with us today.
Thank you, Elaine. It's great to be talking to you.
Well, you've written so many titles about Titanic. Where and how did your personal fascination with the ship and the story begin?
Well, I think it began when I was about 12, when I saw A Night to Remember on television. And I remember my brother saying to me, "What would you do? What would you do if you were on the Titanic?" And I think that's something Walter Lord did so brilliantly with his book and the film based on it, was make us all feel we were there. And what would we do if, you know, we were on this sinking ship? And I think that is part of the reason for the fascination of the Titanic. Of course, later I would meet Walter Lord and some of the survivors of the Titanic when I worked with Robert Ballard, the man who discovered the Titanic, on his book. And I asked Walter to write an introduction for that book and for several other books that I did as an editor and publisher as well. So that's where it really all started. And then when I was, you know, in my early 30s, working as an editor for a small publishing company, we had this amazing coup where Robert Ballard found the ship. And before he did, we'd met with him and said, "Look, if you find this ship, we would really love to do your book." And so I spent 2 years working with him on his book, The Discovery of the Titanic, which became an international bestseller. And I thought, when that was all done, that I was done with the Titanic. But then publishers just wanted more books about the Titanic because they discovered the Titanic really interests people. So we did a lot of books about the Titanic.
And what's the process you use to uncover new facts about a historical event like Titanic? How long is the research period, and how do you really get started with the writing?
Well, the research period, I guess, has been about 25 years because I started working on the Titanic in about 1985 when I started working with Ballard. And I've just never been able to get away from the story, but it's ongoing, including this morning. You know, I continue to do research. I thought I had the research done for this book, but all the time there are new things being uncovered about the passengers, which is what my new book is about, and new things that I need to research all the time.
Well, of the famous people, the glitterati who were on the ship, Benjamin Guggenheim, John Jacob Astor, who, in your opinion, acted the most gallantly, and then who acted the most cowardly?
Well, I actually think that it wasn't the glitterati who behaved the most gallantly. I really think, you know, the crewmen, the engineers who kept the lights going, you know, Thomas Andrews, the ship's builder, who knew it was going to sink and made no effort to save himself, but made sure that women in particular and children got into lifeboats. To me, those are the real heroes of the story.
Is there any new information on the sinking, something that's been discovered most recently?
Well, that's not what I'm writing about. I'm writing about the passengers, and there's lots that's new, new research about passengers. I'm not sure there's much more to be told about the actual sinking or how it sank. There are new theories all the time on everything from the fact that the steel was too brittle to just recently the granddaughter of Second Officer Lightoller, who was the senior surviving officer, made some headlines to promote a novel that she's just written in which she said that her grandfather told her grandmother that the man at the wheel actually steered the ship into the iceberg. You know? So a lot of these new theories about the ship, I think, are bogus, and I have no interest in that. What interests me is this remarkable cast of characters, this, you know, incredible slice of the Gilded Age that is so beautifully represented on the Titanic as a microcosm of its era.
When the passengers realized that the ship would indeed sink, did any of them leave notes or letters that were subsequently discovered?
Yeah, I thought that was an interesting question, Elaine, because, again, most of the so-called notes that were left were fairly bogus. I mean, there was a famous note that has made its way into Walter Lord's books and a number of others from one of the gamblers who was on board, supposedly. There were three professional gamblers, card sharps on board, who were playing cards in the smoking room and fleecing passengers. And one of them was supposedly this gambler named J.H. Rogers. And there is a note that said, you know, if saved, you know, contact my wife and so forth. And then at the end it says lost J.H. Rogers. And this was believed for years until somebody, a researcher whom I know, tracked it all down and found out that Rogers was never on the Titanic. He was a crook who the police were looking for, and he persuaded a woman to give this note to a newspaper office after the Titanic sank, so that he could pretend he died on the Titanic and get the police off his trail.
That's pretty ingenious.
Yeah. So that's pretty clever. There was also a note found in a bottle off Ireland from one of the Irish passengers. But again, nobody knows if that's genuine or not. You know, the Titanic, it took about 2.5 hours to sink. Most people were either complacent, thinking the ship wasn't going to sink, or they were busily getting into lifeboats. They weren't really writing notes.
In your new book, you write about Brooke Astor, the daughter-in-law of John Jacob Astor, and how the circumstances of her recent death became the last Astor scandal. Can you give us a sneak peek about that story?
Well, that's a pretty well-known story. To be honest, I haven't written it yet because that's the last chapter. But to me, it is interesting how these stories go on and the Titanic, you know, the last survivor, for instance, just died last year. She was a baby, of course, didn't remember much, but, and then just, you know, I think the year before that, big newspaper story about Brooke Astor's son being convicted of defrauding her estate, her $200 million estate of money, and he was tried and convicted for that. And I thought, isn't it amazing that the daughter-in-law of a man who was on the Titanic, you know, only just died. So the story has resonance and has impact to this very day, which is what fascinates me.
With all your historical research, what actually do you think about were there inconsistencies and errors in the Cameron's film, or was it pretty straight on?
Well, I'm a fan of the Cameron movie. I don't like to slag it because, you know, I worked with James Cameron. In fact, his film was partially inspired by a book that I worked on called Titanic and Illustrated History, which had these marvelous paintings by a guy named Ken Marshall, who's the ultimate Titanic artist. And Don Lynch was the historical advisor. And they both, Cameron loved the book, and so did us a lot of good. And I would say that the look of the Titanic and the events of the sinking are as accurate as you will ever get in any Titanic movie. But of course, the story, being for a movie, is fictionalized and is a little fanciful. And, you know, third class boys didn't have, you know, affairs with girls in first class and so forth. That's all a little bit fanciful. And the famous scene, of course, where they embrace, you know, at the very bow of the Titanic. Well, that's the forecastle deck of the ship, or the forecastle deck, as it was known. And passengers weren't allowed there. So the chances of the two of them embracing at the prow of the Titanic is a little bit fanciful. But yet it's a highly gripping film. And without that love story, you know, how popular would it have been? We don't know. But certainly the way the Titanic looks on that film and the efforts that Cameron went to make the film look accurate are absolutely extraordinary.
Well,
it's coming out again in 3D for the anniversary in 2012. So that'll be something to see.
Right. Well, Hugh, you've written both fiction and nonfiction. Do you mm-hmm. personally prefer one over the other?
Well, I've only recently written nonfiction for young readers. I always thought I was fiction. I always thought I was a nonfiction guy. And Scholastic, who are a big children's publisher, said, would you write a novel for us? And they had an idea. And I said, I'll have to think about that. I've never done that. But I actually found it liberating to write fiction because I could use dialogue, for instance. And I could get into the heads of historical characters. And to me, writing fiction was more real in a way than writing nonfiction, and quite liberating. So I like doing both. I mean, this book, Gilded Lives, Fatal Voyage, that HarperCollins is publishing in 2012 for the anniversary, is nonfiction. Yet I've done a novel called that I've just completed. It's not out yet either, called Fatal Voyage for Scholastic. And it's a novel for kids. And I think it's as every bit as real as the nonfiction book, because being a nonfiction kind of guy, I can't make things up. You know, I can't fictionalize too much. I have to make it accurate.
Well, what's your next project after you finish the two Titanic efforts that you're doing?
I'm not absolutely certain. I've written a book in the past about the last Tsar of Russia's family, about Anastasia, his famous daughter, which was nonfiction. And the last Grand Duchess of Russia, the last princess, sister of the Tsar, actually died here in Toronto, where I live. And I've talked to some of her family, and she lived an incredible life. So I'm noodling with the idea of a novel about her life called The Emperor's Daughter. But mm-hmm. we'll see if that comes to pass.
Oh, all right. Well, thank you so much, Hugh. I know that you are a Titanic expert, and it's really interesting to get these informational bits from you. Thank you so much.
My pleasure, Elaine. Great to talk to you.
All righty. Bye.
Traditional advertising can be expensive and wasteful. But lately, you've been hearing a lot about social media and viral marketing. But let's be honest, it's confusing. That's why you need Magic Buzz, a new marketing company so unique, we've even coined a special phrase for what we do. Socio-viral. We combine the word-of-mouth friendliness of social media, like Facebook, Twitter, together with the viral reach power of YouTube, to create the socio-viral effect. The Magic Buzz team makes sure our clients are well-represented online. We recently took word-of-mouth advertising to the number one position as most productive medium for a major cell phone company. That's right. Magic Buzz produced more sales than an expensive TV campaign at a fraction of the cost. Put the power of socio-viral marketing to work for you. Visit us at magicbuzz.com. MAGICBUZ.com. If you have any questions, please feel free to email us at info@magicbuzz.com. Magic Buzz, we're there when you can't be.
One of the most extraordinary survival stories ever told, 127 hours between a rock and a hard place, is Aaron Ralston's searing account of his 6 days trapped in one of the most remote spots in America, and how one inspired act of bravery brought him home. The movie, starring James Franco, is up for Top Picture of the Year, as well as 5 other Oscar nods. The story starts out with a simple hike in the Utah Canyonlands on a warm Saturday afternoon. For Aaron Ralston, a 27-year-old mountaineer and outdoorsman, a walk into the remote Blue John Canyon was a chance to find himself in his element, alone, with the beauty of the natural world all around him. In a deep and narrow slot canyon, Aaron was climbing down off a wedged boulder when the rock suddenly came loose. Before he could get out of the way, the falling stone pinned his right hand and wrist against the canyon wall. And so began 6 days of hell for Ralston, with scant water and little food, no jacket for the painfully cold nights, and the terrible knowledge that he'd told no one where he was headed. He found himself facing a lingering death, trapped by an 800-pound boulder 100 feet down in the bottom of a canyon. As he eliminated his escape options one by one through the days, Aaron faced the full horror of his predicament. By the time any possible search and rescue effort would begin, he'd most probably have died of dehydration, if a flash flood didn't drown him first. Using the video camera from his pack, Aaron began recording his grateful goodbyes to his family and friends all over the country and documenting a last will and testament with the hope that someone would find it. The knowledge of their love kept Aaron Ralston alive until a divine inspiration solved the riddle of the boulder. Aaron then committed the most extreme act imaginable to save himself. Let's listen as the author himself narrates.
At the Great Gallery, dozens of 8 to 10 foot high superhumans hover en echelon over groups of indistinct animals, dominating beasts and onlookers alike with their long, dark bodies, broad shoulders, and haunting eyes. The superbly massive apparitions are the oldest and best examples of their design type in the world. Such preeminent specimens that anthropologists have named the heavy and somewhat sinister artistic mode of their creators the Barrier Creek style. Though there is no written record to help us decipher the artist's meaning, a few of the figures appear to be hunters with spears and clubs. Most of them, legless, armless, and horned, seem to float like nightmarish demons. Whatever their intended significance, the mysterious forms are remarkable for their ability to carry a declaration of ego across the millennia and confront the modern observer with the fact that the panels have survived longer and are in better condition than all but the oldest golden artifacts of Western civilization. This provokes the question, what will remain of today's ostensibly advanced societies 5,000 years hence? Probably not our artwork, nor any evidence of our record amounts of leisure time, if for no other reason than most of us fritter away this luxury in front of our television sets. In anticipation of the wet and muddy conditions in the canyon, I'm wearing a pair of beat-up running shoes and thick wool-blend socks. Thus insulated, my feet sweat as they pump on my bike pedals. My legs sweat, too, compressed by the Lycra biking shorts I'm wearing beneath my beige nylon shorts. Even through double-thick padding, my bike seat pummels my rear end. Up top, I have on a favorite fish t-shirt and a blue baseball cap. I left my waterproof jacket back at my truck. The day is going to be warm and dry, just like it was yesterday when I biked the 12-mile loop of the Slick Rock Trail over east of Moab. If it were going to be rainy, a slot canyon would be the last place I'd be headed, jacket or no. Lightweight travel is a pleasure to me, and I figured out how to do more with less so I can go farther in a given amount of time. Yesterday, I had just my small Camelback with a few bike repair items and my cameras, a measly 10-pound load for the 4-hour loop ride. In the evening, pairing out the bike gear, I hiked 5 miles on an out-and-back visit to a natural arch out toward Castle Valley, carrying only 6 pounds total of water and camera equipment. The day before, Thursday, with my friend Brad Ewell from Aspen, I'd climbed and skied Mount Sopris, the 12,995-foot monarch of western Colorado, and had carried a few extra clothes and backcountry avalanche rescue gear, but I still kept my load under 15 pounds. My 5-day road trip will culminate on Sunday night with an unsupported solo attempt to mountain bike the 108-mile White Rim Trail in Canyonlands National Park. If I carried the supplies I'd used over the 3 days it took me the first time I rode that trail in 2000, I'd have a 60-pound pack and a sore back before I went 10 miles. In my planning estimates this time around, I'm hoping to carry 15 pounds and complete the loop in under 24 hours. It will mean following a precision-charted water management plan to capitalize on the scarce refilling opportunities, no sleeping, and only the bare minimum of stopping. My biggest worry isn't that my legs will get tired. I know they will, and I know how to handle it. But rather that my undercarriage will become too sensitive to allow me to ride. As I haven't ridden my bike any extended distance since last summer, My bike saddle tolerance is disconcertingly low. Had I anticipated this trip prior to 2 nights ago, I would have gone out for at least one long ride in the Aspen area beforehand. As it happened, some friends and I called off a mountaineering trip at the last moment on Wednesday. The cancellation freed me for a hodge to the desert, a pilgrimage for warmth, to reacquaint myself with a landscape other than wintry mountains. Usually I would leave a detailed schedule of my plans with my roommates, but since I left my home in Aspen without knowing what I was going to do, the only word of my destination I gave was Utah. I briefly researched my trip options by consulting my guidebooks as I drove from Mount Sopris to Utah Thursday night. The result has been a capriciously impromptu vacation, one that will even incorporate dropping in on a big campout party near Goblin Valley State Park tonight. It's nearing 10:30 a.m. as I pedal into the shade of a very lonesome juniper and survey my sun-baked surroundings. The rolling scrub desert gradually drops away into a region of painted rock domes, hidden cliffs, weathered and warped bluffs, tilted and tortured canyons, and broken monoliths. This is hoodoo country. This is voodoo country. The red wasteland beyond the end of the roads. Since I arrived after dark last night, I wasn't able to see much of the landscape on my drive into the trailhead. As I scan the middle ground to the east for any sign of my destination canyon, I take out my chocolate muffin from the Moab Groceries bakery and have to practically choke it down. Both the muffin and my mouth have dried out from the exposure to the arid wind. I wash down the muffin, except for a few crumbs in the wrapper, with several pulls from the Camelback's hydration tube fastened to my shoulder strap. Remounting, I roll down the road in the wind-protected lee of the ridgeline in front of me, but at the top of the next hill, I'm thrust into battle against the gusts once more. After another 20 minutes pistoning my legs along this blast furnace of a road, I see a group of motorbikers passing me on their way to the Maze District of Canyonlands. The dust from the motorbikes blows straight into my face, clogging my nose, my ears, my tear ducts, even gluing itself to my teeth. I grimace at the grit pasted on my lips, lick my teeth clean, and press on, thinking about where those bikers would be headed. I visited the Maze only once myself for about a half an hour, nearly 10 years ago. When our Cataract Canyon rafting party pulled over in the afternoon to set up camp along the Colorado River at a beach called Spanish Bottom, I hiked 1,000 feet up over the rim rock into a place known as the Doll's House. 50 to 100 foot tall hoodoo rock formations towered above me as I scrambled around the sandstone and granite like a Lilliputian. When I finally turned around to look back at the river, I jerked to a halt and sat on the nearest boulder with a view. It was the first time the features and formative processes of the desert had made me pause and absorb just how small and brave we are, we the human race. Down behind the boats at Spanish Bottom, a furious river churned. Suddenly, I perceived in its auburn flow that it was, even at that exact moment, carving that very canyon from 1,000 square miles of desert tablelands. From the Doll's House, I had the unexpected impression that I was watching the ongoing birth of an entire landscape, as if I were standing on the rim of an exploding caldera. The vista held for me a feeling of the dawn of time, that primordial epoch before life when there was only desolate land. Like looking through a telescope into the Milky Way and wondering if we're alone in the universe, it made me realize with the glaring clarity of desert light how scarce and delicate life is, how insignificant we are when compared with the forces of nature and the dimensions of space. Were my group to board those two rafts a mile in the distance and depart, I would be as cut off from human contact as a person could be. In 15 to 30 days' time, I would starve in a lonely death as I hiked the meanders back upriver to Moab, never again to see the sign or skin of another human. Yet beyond the paucity and the solitude of the surrounding desert, it was an exultant thought that peeled back the veneer of our self-important delusions. We are not grand because we are at the top of the food chain, or because we can alter our environment. The environment will outlast us with its unfathomable forces and unyielding powers. But rather than be bound and defeated by our insignificance, we are bold.
Marketing company so unique.
Despite the ephemeral and delicate presence we have in this desert, on this planet, in this universe. I sat for another 10 minutes. Then, with my perspective as widened as the view from that bluff, I returned to camp and made extra short work of dinner. Riding down the road past the metal culvert that marks the dried-up source of the West Fork of Blue John Canyon, I pass through a signed intersection where a branch of the dirt road splits off toward Hanksville, a small town an hour to the west at the gateway to Capitol Reef National Park. Hanksville is the closest settlement to the Robber's Roost country of eastern Utah in the Mays District, and home to the nearest landline public telephone in the region. Just a half mile farther, I pass a slanting grassy plain that was an airstrip until whatever minor catastrophe forced whoever was flying there to head back to more tenable ground. It's an indication of how small planes and helicopters are typically the only efficient means of getting from here to there in this country. Some of the time, though, it's not financially worth leaving here to get there, even if you can fly. Better just to stay at home.
Social media. It's got everyone buzzing these days. But what is it really, and how can you put it to work for you? More than just a passing trend that's hot today, gone tomorrow, social media is marketing that is making a difference for savvy business people who have jumped into the future. Magic Buzz is a new online and coined a special phrase for what we do. Socio-viral. We combine the word-of-mouth friendliness of social media like Facebook and Twitter together with the viral reach power of YouTube to create the socio-viral effect. Magic Buzz's socio-viral solution provides the measurable value of online advertising that works, affordable, and effective. So get the buzz going for your business. Magic Buzz, with only one Z, because we're never asleep. Visit us at magicbuz.com. For more information or any questions, please feel free to email us at info@magicbuzz.com. Magic Buzz, we're there when you can't be.
Much interest swirling around True Grit this year. The movie received 10 nominations in all. Jeff Bridges is up for Best Actor for his role as Rooster Cogburn. If he wins, it will mark two extraordinary events. One, he and John Wayne will have both won the top award for portraying the same character. And two, Bridges will join only two other actors who've won the Best Actor Oscar 2 years in a row. That would be Spencer Tracy, who won in 1937 for Captain's Courageous and again in 1938 for Boys Town, and then Tom Hanks, won in 1993 for Philadelphia and in 1994 for, I know you know this one, Forrest Gump. And Haley Steinfeld as Maddie Ross has been nominated for Best Supporting Actress.
The Coen brothers didn't set out to remake the 1969 movie. Rather, their idea was to bring a faithful version of the novel to the screen. Macabre humor and bursts of violence, dialogue that is at once deadpan and grandiose. They're oddball characters. To quote Jeff Bridges, I was curious why the Coen brothers wanted to remake a movie. Once I read the book, I thought, well, this reads like a Coen brothers script. The characters are so unusual, and the plot twists and turns.
Back to the book. True Grit by Charles Portis follows the story of Maddie Ross, a 14-year-old girl from Arkansas who sets out to avenge her daddy's death, shot down by a no-good outlaw. Maddie convinces the one-eyed Rooster Cogburn, the meanest U.S. Marshal in the land, to ride along with her. Their journey for justice is a true American classic. Donna Tartt narrates the legendary tale.
Before Papa left for Fort Smith, he arranged for a colored man named Yarnell Poindexter to feed the stock and look in on Mama and us every day. Yarnell and his family lived just below us on some land he rented from the bank. He was born of free parents in Illinois, but a man named Bloodworth kidnapped him in Missouri and brought him down to Arkansas just before the war. Yarnell was a good man, thrifty and industrious, and he later became a prosperous house painter in Memphis, Tennessee. We exchanged letters every Christmas until he passed away in the flu epidemic of 1918. To this day, I have never met anybody else named Yarnell, white or black. I attended the funeral and visited in Memphis with my brother, Little Frank, and his family. Instead of going to Fort Smith by steamboat or train, Papa decided he would go on horseback and walk the ponies back all tied together. Not only would it be cheaper, but it would be a pleasant outing for him and a good ride. Nobody loved to gad about on a prancing steed more than Papa. I have never been very fond of horses myself, although I believe I was accounted a good enough rider in my youth. I never was afraid of animals. I remember once I rode a mean goat through a plum thicket on a dare. From our place to Fort Smith was about 70 miles as a bird flies, taking you past beautiful Mount Nebo, where we had a little summer house so Mama could get away from the mosquitoes, and also Mount Magazine, the highest point in Arkansas. But it might as well have been 700 miles for all I knew of Fort Smith. The boats went up there, and some people sold their cotton up there, but that was all I knew about it. We sold our cotton down in Little Rock. I had been there two or three times. Papa left us on his saddle horse, a big chestnut mare with a blazed face called Judy. He took some food and a change of clothes rolled up in some blankets and covered with a slicker. This was tied behind his saddle. He wore his belt gun, which was a big, long dragoon pistol, the cap and ball kind that was old-fashioned even at that time. He had carried it in the war. He was a handsome sight, and in my memory's eye, I can still see him, mounted up there on Judy in his brown woolen coat and black Sunday hat, and the both of them, man and beast, blowing little clouds of steam on that frosty morn. He might have been a gallant knight of old. Tom Cheney rode his gray horse that was better suited to pulling a middle buster than carrying a rider. He had no handgun, but he carried his rifle slung across his back on a piece of cotton plow line. There is trash for you. He could have taken an old piece of harness and made a nice leather strap for it. That would have been too much trouble. Papa had right around $250 in his purse, as I had reason to know since I kept his books for him. Mama was never any good at sums, and she could hardly spell cat. I do not boast of my own gifts in that direction. Figures and letters are not everything. Like Martha, I have always been agitated and troubled by the cares of the day, but my mother had a serene and loving heart. She was like Mary and had chosen that good part. The two gold pieces that Papa carried concealed in his clothes were a marriage gift from my grandfather Sperling in Monterey, California. Little did Papa realize that morning that he was never to see us or hold us again, nor would he ever again hearken to the meadowlarks of Yale County trilling a joyous anthem to spring. The news came like a thunderclap. Here is what happened. Papa and Tom Cheney arrived in Fort Smith and took a room at the Monarch boarding house. They called on Stonehill at his stock barn and looked over the ponies. It fell out there was not a mare in the lot, or a stallion for that matter. The Texas cowboys rode nothing but geldings for some cowboy reason of their own, and you can imagine they are no good for breeding purposes. But Papa was not to be turned back. He was determined to own some of those little brutes, and on the second day he bought four of them for $100 even, bringing Stonehill down from his asking price of $140. It was a good enough buy. They made plans to leave the next morning. That night, Tom Cheney went to a bar room and got into a game of cards with some riffraff like himself and lost his wages. He did not take the loss like a man, but went back to the room at the boarding house and sulled up like a possum. He had a bottle of whiskey, and he drank that. Papa was sitting in the parlor talking to some drummers. By and by, Cheney came out of the bedroom with his rifle. He said he had been cheated and was going back to the bar room and get his money. Papa said that if he had been cheated, then they'd best go talk to the law about it. Cheney would not listen. Papa followed him outside and told him to surrender the rifle, as he was in no fit state to start a quarrel with a gun in his hand. My father was not armed at that time. Tom Cheney raised his rifle and shot him in the forehead, killing him instantly. There was no more provocation than that, and I tell it as it was told to me by the High Sheriff of Sebastian County. Some people might say, "Well, what business was it of Frank Ross to meddle?" My answer is this. He was trying to do that short devil a good turn. Cheney was a tenant, and Papa felt responsibility. He was his brother's keeper. Does that answer your question?
Traditional advertising can be expensive and wasteful. But lately, you've been hearing a lot about social media and viral marketing. But let's be honest, it's confusing. That's why you need Magic Buzz, a new marketing company so unique, we've even coined a special phrase for what we do. Socio-viral. We combine the word-of-mouth friendliness of social media, like Facebook, Twitter, together with the viral reach power of YouTube, to create the socio-viral effect. The Magic Buzz team makes sure our clients are well represented online. We recently took word-of-mouth advertising to the number one position as most productive medium for a major cell phone company. That's right. Magic Buzz produced more sales than an expensive TV campaign at a fraction of the cost. Put the power of socio-viral marketing to work for you. Visit us at magicbuzz.com. MagicBuzz.com.
Vulnerability are both irresistible.
Free to email us at info@magicbuzz.com. Magic Buzz, we're there when you can't be.
Winter's Bone is a Best Picture nominee that hasn't had the amount of buzz of some of the other films. The book was written by Daniel Woodrell and completely believable, much like Scout in my own personal favorite movie, To Kill a Mockingbird. The sheriff's deputy brings hard news to Ree. Her father has skipped bail on charges that he ran a crystal meth lab. The family will lose their house if he doesn't show up for his next court date. Ree's father has disappeared before. The Dolly clan has worked the shadowy side of the law for generations, and arrests and attempts to avoid them are part of their family life. With two young brothers depending on her, 16-year-old Ree knows she has to bring her father back, dead or alive. She's grown up in the harsh poverty of the Ozarks and learns quickly that asking questions can be a fatal mistake. But along the way to a shocking revelation, Ree discovers unforeseen depths in herself and in a family network that protects its own at any cost. Like his characters, and especially his teen characters, Woodrell's prose mixes tough and tender, thoroughly yet delicately. This touching, memorable tale is narrated by Emma Galvin.
Maybe tonight Blonde Milton will bring us by one to eat. That could be. Don't Ken ought to? That's what is always said. Could be we should ask. She looked at Harold with his easy smile, black hair rifling in the wind, then snatched his nearest ear and twisted until his jaw fell loose, and he raised his hand to swat at hers. She twisted until he bore up under the pain and stopped swatting. Never. Never ask for what ought to be offered. I'm cold, he said. He rubbed his smarting ear. Is grits all we got? Butter and more. There's still a tad of butter. He held the door, and they both stepped inside. No, there ain't. Mom sat in her chair beside the pot belly, and the boys sat at the table, eating what Ree fed them. Mom's morning pills turned her into a cat, a breathing thing that sat near heat and occasionally made a sound. Mom's chair was an old padded rocker that seldom rocked, and at odd instants she'd hum ill-matched snips of music, notes unrelated by melody or pitch. But for most of any day she was quiet and still, wearing a small lingering smile prompted by something vaguely nice going on inside her head. She was a Bromont, born to this house, and she'd once been pretty. Even as she was now, medicated and lost to the present, with hair she forgot to wash or brush, and deep wrinkles growing on her face, you could see she'd once been as comely as any girl that ever danced barefoot across this tangled country of Ozark hills and hollers. Long, dark, and lovely she had been in those days before her mind broke and the parts scattered and she let them go. Ree said, "Finish up eating. Boss will be along soon." The house had been built in 1914. The ceilings were high, and the single light overhead threw dour shadows behind everything. Warped shadow shapes lay trees, looming rock-like bulged in the corners. The house was cool in the brighter spots and chill in the shadows. Windows set high into the walls, and outside the panes torn plastic sheeting from the winter before whipped and fluttered. The furniture came into the house when Mama and Granddad Bromont were alive, had been in use since Mom was a child, and the lumpy stuffing and worn fabric yet held the scent of Granddad's pipe tobacco and 10,000 dusty days, and a thin mud trail. Storm wind shoved limbs around and whistled past the window frame, hooted down the stovepipe. The sky came into the valley low, glum and blustery, about to bust open in snow. Sunny said, "These socks smell."
Would you just put him on? You'll miss the bus.
Harold said,
My socks smell too. Would you just please put those socks on? Would you do that, huh?
Sonny and Harold were 18 months apart in age. They nearly always went about shoulder to shoulder, running side by side and turning this way or veering that way at the same sudden instant, without a word, moving about in a spooky, instinctive tandem, like scampering quotation marks. Sonny, the older boy, was 10, seed from a brute, strong, hostile, and direct. His hair was the color of a fallen oak leaf. His fists made hard young knots, and he'd become a scrapper at school. Harold trailed Sonny and tried to do as he did. But he lacked the same sort of punishing spirit and muscle, and often came home in need of fixing, bruised or sprained or humiliated. Harold said, They don't really stink that bad, Ree. Sonny said, Yeah, they do, but it don't matter. They'll be in our boots. Ree's grand hope was that these boys would not be dead to wonder by age 12, dulled to life, empty of kindness, boiling with mean. So many Dolly kids were that way, ruined before they had chin hair, groomed to live outside square law and abide by the remorseless, blood-soaked commandments that govern lives led outside square law. There were 200 Dollies, plus Lockrums, Boschels, Tankerslies, and Langens, who were basically Dollies by marriage, living within 30 miles of this valley.
Social media. It's got everyone buzzing these days. But what is it, really? And how can you put it to work for you? More than just a passing trend that's hot today, gone tomorrow. Social media is marketing that is making a difference for savvy business people who have jumped into the future. Magic Buzz is a new online marketing company so unique, we've even coined a special phrase for what we do. Socio-viral. We combine the word-of-mouth friendliness of social media like Facebook and Twitter together with the viral reach power of YouTube to create the socio-viral effect. Magic Buzz's socio-viral solution provides the measurable value of online advertising that works, affordable, and effective. So get the buzz going for your business. Magic Buzz, with only one Z, because we're never asleep. Visit us at magicbuz.com. For more information or any questions, please feel free to email us at info@magicbuzz.com. Magic Buzz, we're there when you can't be.
Publication of Alice's Adventures in Wonderland in 1865 and Through the Looking Glass 6 years later, Lewis Carroll's nonsensical tales have delighted the world with wildly imaginative and unforgettable journeys. This year, Tim Burton's movie with Johnny Depp and Helena Bonham Carter has been nominated for awards in visual effects, art direction, and costume design. The Alice stories are not for children only. We all know that many a college kid has wondered what Mr. Carroll may have been smoking when he created his tales and his characters. But a true appreciation of the work recognizes it as a gentle satire on education, politics, literature, and Victorian life in general. In this version, veteran actor Christopher Plummer takes listeners of all ages through a wonderfully enjoyable trip through Alice's adventures down the rabbit hole and through the Looking Glass, including The Wasp in a Wig, a lost episode of Through the Looking Glass that you may never have heard before. Let's listen.
And burning with curiosity, she ran across the field after it and was just in time to see it pop down a large rabbit hole under the hedge. In another moment, down went Alice after it, never once considering how in the world she was to get out again. The rabbit hole went straight on like a tunnel for some way, and then dipped suddenly down, so suddenly that Alice had not a moment to think about stopping herself before she found herself falling down what seemed to be a very deep well. Either the well was very deep, or she fell very slowly, for she had plenty of time as she went down to look about her and to wonder what was going to happen next. First, she tried to look down and make out what she was coming to, but it was too dark to see anything. Then she looked at the sides of the well and noticed that they were filled with cupboards and bookshelves. Here and there she saw maps and pictures hung upon pegs. She took down a jar from one of the shelves as she passed. It was labeled Orange Marmalade, but to her great disappointment it was empty. She did not like to drop the jar for fear of killing somebody underneath, so managed to put it into one of the cupboards as she fell past it. Well, thought Alice to herself, after such a fall as this, I shall think nothing of tumbling downstairs. How brave they'll all think me at home. Why, I wouldn't say anything about it even if I fell off the top of the house, which was very likely true. Down, down, down would the fall never come to an end. I wonder how many miles I've fallen by this time, she said aloud. I must be getting somewhere near the center of the earth. Let me see, that would be 4,000 miles down, I think. For you see, Alice had learnt several things of this sort in her lessons in the schoolroom, and though this was not a very good opportunity for showing off her knowledge, as there was no one to listen to her, still it was good practice to say it over. Yes, that's about the right distance. But then I wonder what latitude or longitude I've got to. Alice had not the slightest idea what latitude was, or longitude either, but she thought they were nice, grand words to say. Presently she began again. I wonder if I shall fall right through the earth. How funny it'll seem to come out among the people that walk with their heads downwards. The antipathies, I think. She was rather glad there was no one listening this time, as it didn't sound at all the right word. But I shall have to ask them what the name of the country is, you know. Please, ma'am, is this New Zealand or Australia? And she tried to curtsy as she spoke. Fancy curtsying as you're falling through the air. Do you think you could manage it? And what an ignorant little girl she'll think me for asking. No, it'll never do to ask. Perhaps I shall see it written up somewhere. Down, down, down. There was nothing else to do, so Alice soon began talking again. Dinah'll miss me very much tonight, I should think. Dinah was the cat. I hope they'll remember her saucer of milk at tea time. Dinah, my dear, I wish you were down here with me. There are no mice in the air, I'm afraid, but you might catch a bat, and that's very like a mouse, you know. But do cats eat bats, I wonder? And here Alice began to get rather sleepy and went on saying to herself in a dreamy sort of way, do cats eat bats? Do cats eat bats? And sometimes, do bats eat cats? For you see, as she couldn't answer either question, it didn't much matter which way she put it. She felt that she was dozing off and had just begun to dream that she was walking hand in hand with Dinah and was saying to her very earnestly, now, Dinah, tell me the truth. Did you ever eat a bat? When suddenly, thump, thump, down she came upon a heap of sticks and dry leaves, and the fall was over. Alice was not a bit hurt, and she jumped up onto her feet in a moment. She looked up, but it was all dark overhead. Before her was another long passage, and the white rabbit was still in sight, hurrying down it. There was not a moment to be lost. Away went Alice like the wind, and was just in time to hear it say, as it turned a corner, oh, my ears and whiskers, how late it's getting. She was close behind it when she turned the corner, but the rabbit was no longer to be seen. She found herself in a long, low hall, which was lit up by a row of lamps hanging from the roof. There were doors all round the hall, but they were all locked, and when Alice had been all the way down one side and up the other, trying every door, she walked sadly down the middle, wondering how she was...
The curtain's coming down on this week's journey through the books that have made the jump to the big screen. I hope you've been enticed by a few titles. Be sure to check out all these titles and more on the show's new website, www.bookreportradio.com. And you can always write to me at elaine@bookreportradio.com. And to all my book-loving friends, happy Valentine's Day. This is Elaine Charles. See you next week for the next chapter of The Book Report.